We're looking at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife now with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. I hope you'll call in with your questions as we move along today at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Scott, welcome back. Nice to have you with us again.
Well, it's good to be here. Every month that I'm on is one month closer to spring. I don't know about you, but I am sick and tired of winter weather.
I am done. I am done with winter, and I'm ready for spring. And I was talking to Darren Bush yesterday from Rutabaga Canoes, and Canoe-copia is this weekend. And he said he was working on the mayor to have of Madison to have spring change to this coming weekend. And he said,
idea.
He even talked to a meteorologist who said, well, no, we can't really do it scientifically, but maybe you can do it politically. So he's going to try and do it politically.
Well, I think we do go on daylight savings time.
Yeah, we spring ahead on Saturday night.
Great. So in addition to getting up in the cold in the morning, we get up in the pitch black.
Yeah,
perfect.
I'll tell you what, I like that longer light in the evening, though, in the afternoon. With all this crummy weather we've had, especially in southern Wisconsin. Northern Wisconsin has not experienced it, I don't think, to the extent. In fact, I think the snow fall in Eau Claire is about half that of Madison. Still, could cause some concern for some of our wildlife.
Well, it has definitely caused a lot of concern. Whether it's caused any real impacts or not remains to be seen. At least in the central and northern part of the state, the winter severity index that the DNR calculates every year to attempt to judge what impacts might be on wildlife has only reached at best the moderate category, and it looks like it's supposed to warm up next week. So, as you said, for most of central and northern Wisconsin, it's been winter, but it's been more normal than what we've had for the past 15 or 20 years. In the southern part of the state, however, we've had record amounts of snow, and it's been cold, and we've had no thaw to expose bare ground. So I think that, you know, the deer are probably okay. The turkeys are probably okay. Although I've had a few people call and say, you know, I had 12 or 14 turkeys coming into the feeder or roosting in the tree, and now there's 4 or 8 or 10 or something. So they're kind of on the edge. But I think real impacts, if they occur, will be to the smaller birds. I think everyone agrees that quail, which were making a bit of a comeback in southern Wisconsin, have probably taken a big hit. No, yeah. Not all of them. Some will make it. I had a report of a covey of quail just a week ago. So some will make it through. But I think the pheasants will also take a hit. At least they certainly seem to have taken a hit around my place. But again, some will make it through, and they'll bounce back. It's not a catastrophic situation. But it's been a tough winter for people and wildlife alike.
Well, all our lines are filled, and I think it's time to get to those lines. And our listeners here, Jay in La Crosse, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
I go to the Trempealeau Wildlife Refuge quite often, and there are seeps and springs where the water has remained open, and there are just tens of thousands of bullheads gathered in this open water, almost solid, and then hundreds of them dead on the ice with, you know, from either raptor evidence or I think there's some otter slides or there's at least signs of otter activity as well. But in a lot of the open water, it's just solid bullheads and some are dead. Usually the bit larger ones are dead and the smaller ones are sucking air. And I'm just curious as to whether this is a healthy ecosystem or something in trouble.
Yeah. Well, usually in winters like this with heavy ice cover and heavy snow cover on the ice and
especially
so forth. Especially the snow cover. You get winter kill and shallow bodies of water where the oxygen just basically is gone. And it's tough on the fish populations. In some cases, there may be a complete die-off of the fish population. But that's the reason in small farm ponds and shallow ponds that people are managing, you see these aerators and other attempts to keep some oxygen in the water. So in this case, with a little bit of open water or seep, the bullheads and whatever else is in there are gravitating to those spots as a last attempt to get a breath of air. And the fact that some are dying off only reflects that oxygen problem. But, you know, it's an ill wind that blows no one good. So the otters and the raptors and everybody else that likes to dine on bullheads is probably benefiting from the situation. But these things occur routinely around the state. And as we just, you know, indicated with snow and ice effects on wildlife, the fish populations will bounce back.
Yeah, we sure hope so. And I remember seeing a photo. This is an old photo, but it was a photo of a hole, an ice hole, and literally the fish had completely, the heads were completely
just sticking up,
sticking up from the hole, jam-packed in that hole, and dead, of course, frozen. So it happens, but they come back. Jay, thanks for calling. Susan in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I was concerned about the robins that are coming back. They hang around my feeders, and I was wondering if there was anything that I could put out to feed them.
Well, if you visit some of the wild bird feeding stores and centers and so forth, they're actually seed mixes now. They're you know, on the high end in terms of a price, but certainly availability that includes some dried fruits and other such things in the seed mix that the robins will actually use. But you could try things like raisins and chopped apple and whatnot and see what how they respond. And if they're responding to something, go with it.
I see. I've been putting out the remains of my parrot food, and they've been eating the dried fruit out of that.
Well, sure. That's primarily what they're interested in. So put out whatever you have, and they'll utilize it. And it's a good point to think about. One thing we'll probably talk about later is the influx of seed catalogs recently, and as people are thinking about their planting and landscape designs for the spring, think about some of the shrubs that hold fruits through the winter and just now are very important to birds that are either caught up short in late winter or early spring by weather. And things like high bush cranberry, which is a very attractive landscape shrub and holds those red fruits until this time of year, as well as some of the crab apples and hawthorns and so forth. And that's good for the robins this time of year. But if it's not available, you can provide it in seed mixes.
Thanks, Susan, for calling. Roman in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Roman.
Hi. Appreciate your program this morning especially. I got a very small bird house in our yard. We moved here to central Wisconsin 10 years ago, and there was a family of birds that summer in that house. I didn't do anything. I got a bird feeder in the yard, but the next year we didn't have any birds in the house, and the following year neither. So the third year I decided maybe I better clean out the nest that was in there. That might have been the way to go, and I did. And then for several more years, so we didn't have any birds in the house. Now, this last summer, finally a nest of birds used the house. I don't know what they were. They were small. I don't know if it was something between a sparrow and a wren, but I don't think it was a wren. But
house
now,
finch, maybe.
Should I clean out the house, or should I just leave it? That's the question.
Well, that was another thing I'd hoped to cover today, so you've given us a good segue into that, Roman. This is a time of year when if you can fight your way through the snowdrifts, which I haven't managed to do yet, I've got to get out and clean out my bluebird houses and the tree swallow boxes and so forth, not only because of previous year's nesting material, but because I know every one of those houses right now is just chock-a-block full of mice.
Mice, yeah.
So I have to open the box, evict all the mice, and they'll scatter in every direction, and then boot out all the nesting material that they've hauled in, which is usually plant down and things like that, and they'll be packed from floor to entrance. If you don't do that, you simply will have no birds. They have no opportunity. They'll bring in their own nesting material. So the long and short of it is, this is a good time to get out there, clean them out, repair them, make sure you have access to the house through a panel that opens with a hinge or whatever on the side, or take them in, repair them, build new houses. Whatever you need to do, this is the time to be ready for the birds as they come back over the next couple months.
And there's an extension publication available on building birdhouses and repairing them. Scott, you wrote that, didn't you?
Yes, I think the number is NCR338 for the North Central region. It's called Shells, Houses, and Feeders for Birds and Squirrels, and mammals, rather. And there are all sorts of designs in there. So if you don't have any birdhouses, you can, of course, buy them. But it's also a good time of year, as it stays cold and snowy, to spend a few hours in the shop and hammer out a few birdhouses and be ready to put them up as soon as the snow starts to disappear. So all sorts. And I should point out, that's the Wisconsin Extension publication. There's another very nice one from Minnesota called Woodworking for Wildlife, which has a whole variety of designs in it. So.
And you can get that at the from your county extension office, or go online to UW Extension's website and get the get that information right off that. Roman, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. We will go to Beloit next. Let's talk to Ivan. Hi, Ivan.
Hi, thanks for calling.
Sure.
I have a squirrel over the past year or so that's turned white, basically. Started at the front of the body, went about halfway back, and then sort of stopped there. Now it's gone all the way back to the tail, but the tail remains dark. It's a gray squirrel. And there's a few light gray spots in the back side of the thigh and so forth. But otherwise, it seems to be healthy. Comes around a little festive, but is doing okay. I'm just curious about it.
Well, so are a lot of other people, Ivan. In the last 12 to 18 months, there have been more reports of odd-colored squirrels, oddly colored gray squirrels, than either I or the people in the Zoological Museum to whom I've been forwarding them to have ever seen. White squirrels, partially white squirrels, yeah. Brown squirrels, dark brown squirrels,
black squirrels,
all kinds of squirrels, and in really odd patterns. And you know, typically you might see a squirrel that's kind of a darker gray and maybe has a light tail, but we've seen squirrels that look like someone picked them up by the tail and dipped them in a bucket of black paint halfway down their body.
Mm-hmm.
So they're black in the front, light in the back, or vice versa. So no one seems to be sure what's going on with squirrel genetics or something, but it's just been a very unusual year for oddly pelaged squirrels.
Okay.
And I can't offer up any explanation. Of course, if there's white involved, you start to think about partial albinism or albinos and so forth. But, you know, that may be the case, but there's something else going on, too.
It changed over the course of time. Just slowly went to the back of the body.
Well, you know, as squirrels molt, as most mammals do, and grow like your dog does, a heavier winter coat, the molt doesn't all occur overnight. It tends to progress in a wave, front or back, depending on the animal.
Sure.
So this may be a case where the molt was occurring normally, but the hair coloration coming in was abnormal for some reason.
Okay.
Interesting. Thanks, Ivan. Appreciate the call. And Becca in Decorah, Iowa, I believe, is up next. So let's go there. Hi, Becca.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live in Iowa, but I had attended Northland College in Ashland, which is way up north.
Yeah.
And I had studied outdoor education, and I got to poke around quite a bit in the North Woods. And I think one of the great things that the tourism department gets to enjoy is that the natural beauty attracts a lot of visitors. And I think Wisconsin is famous for its pristine beauty. And I was wanting to ask what kind of measures are taken to ensure the pristineness remains.
That's a good question. That could take several days to answer.
I guess my first response, Becca, is that probably not enough.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But there are a couple of things going on that come to mind. First of all, if we think about the North Woods, Wisconsin is very fortunate to have the Stewardship Fund, which allows the state to purchase considerable quantities of land to add to the public land base when they become available, so that there's a constant addition of lands to the park system, to the state wildlife areas, to the state natural areas, and so forth. So that's a good thing. That protects it in perpetuity from development. In addition, many counties in the North Woods, and I'd say the North Woods in general, are benefiting from much stronger shoreland zoning regulations than were present in the past. So things like setback regulations, the amount of viewscape a lakeshore property owner can clear to the water, so that people on the lake, instead of just seeing a wall of houses along the lake, actually see something approximating a pristine shoreline. So those are a couple things that come to mind. And I think that in general, the only thing in the long run that will really save the day is a personal ethic amongst those people who live in northern Wisconsin or are contemplating retiring in or moving to northern Wisconsin, that they recognize that what brought them up there, whether it was 40 years ago or next week, is in fact the beauty and attractiveness of the North Woods, and that it then behooves everyone to do what they can to keep it that way.
Yeah. So we also benefit a lot from the fact that we've got a few million acres of national forest up there, too, which helps.
Right. There's a lot of public, unlike southern Wisconsin, there's a great deal of public land in the north, in the state and county forests and in the national forest, and presumably, again, that will be protected.
Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Becca. And we'll take some more calls. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. And join us with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. William and Viola is next. Hi, William.
Hi, good morning. I'm up here in a beautiful Kickapoo Ridge up here in the Kickapoo Valley, in the Kickapoo area. It's absolutely gorgeous out there with all the snow. I was driving down the road, and I spotted a bird sitting on a fence post, and obviously a hawk. When I first looked at it, I thought it was a bald eagle, but it was too small. And it was all gray in color, kind of a soft, creamy gray, really more white than gray. And it had a kind of a red patch on its wing that was kind of a light purple-pink color. And I'm wondering what kind of bird it was.
Where was the patch? It was a run that by me once.
So that
more.
Was on the top surface of the wing?
No, yeah, top surface of the wing.
Top surface,
right.
Okay.
It didn't fly, so I didn't get a chance to see the tail feathers. But it had a head almost like a bald eagle, except they had a smaller beak.
Well, I think William, the first thing I'd recommend, or maybe you've done this already, is to page through a bird field guide and see if one of the illustrations strikes you as what you saw. There is a raptor called a red-shouldered hawk that has reddish patch on its shoulders or the back of its wing, but that would that would be kind of an unusual sighting at this time of year. The large raptors that would likely be around would include a few red-tailed hawks still around and the rough-legged hawks, which are kind of variable in coloration, that kind of replace them during the winter, although they're generally darker. An adult goshawk is kind of a creamy gray in the adult plumage, but no patch on the back of the wing the way you describe it.
Yeah, this was right on, you know, it had its wings folded, so the patch was right on top of the wing.
Well, I
looked it up on the internet, and they have this bird thing. You can type in all the different characteristics, mm-hmm. and then they come up, they said it was probably a merlin.
Well, we learned a long time ago on the program to never say never about unusual sightings, but in the case of the bird situation and the fact that in this great backyard bird count that Larry alluded to a little while ago, there were some pretty unusual sightings around. In this case, we behave like the television show, Do You Want to Be a Millionaire? Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And we sometimes turn to the audience. So if amongst our many thousands of avid birders out there, someone listening has a suggestion as to what William may have actually seen beyond our speculation, feel free to give us a call.
Stay listening, William. Thank you very much for calling. And Marion Portage has a question or comment? Mary, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have not a pretty sighting. It's kind of an unusual sighting. It's a deer that must have gotten hit by a car, and it's been around for about a month. We've seen it about half a dozen times, and its stomach is actually hanging out underneath the body. Is there anything that can be done? I mean, it's not. We've had people suggest somebody could come shoot it, but it doesn't come around with any regularity. But it's just the poor thing. I feel sorry for it. Although it comes to the feeder and eats the bird seed, it eats off our juniper trees. But
well, Mary, that is a tough thing to see. I had a similar set of photographs emailed to me last week of deer that had a leg removed.
Uh-huh.
But in that case, it appeared to be healing over, and it was moving quite capably. And in that case, the deer will probably be all right. I think the fact that internal organs are exposed because of infection and a variety of other possibilities, ultimately the prognosis is not very good for that deer. So the only thing I can think of, I don't think the notion of attempting to capture it and think about, medical care or whatnot is probably not going to do it. But if the euthanasia approach appeals to you, I would contact the DNR wildlife manager for your area,
mm-hmm.
and explain what's going on and you know, see what they say, what they might suggest.
Okay.
All right.
I just feel so sorry for it. Yeah. I know it's got to be suffering.
Well, it is a sad thing. I can just tell you, though, that, you know, deer and most animals that are low down in the food chain, even though deer are large, often die a very violent death, whether it be by highway mortality or predators or hunting. It's what happens to them, and it's most people don't want to think about it and kind of put it out of mind. But when you see something like this, it brings it home. It brings it home. So talk to the local wildlife manager and see if there's an opportunity there to perhaps euthanize it. Although, as you say, you know, it's going to be hard to find somebody who's just willing to kind of sit there for an extended period until the deer actually shows up.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Thanks, Mary.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Jeff in Minocqua is next. Let's go to Jeff. Hi.
Morning, guys.
Morning.
Just wanted to know, we feed the birds, and this year we bought a heated bird bath.
Mm-hmm.
Thought that would be a great idea. Set it up right next to the feeder. And we were really disappointed that nothing really came to the feeder just about all winter, and it wasn't like they couldn't find it because it was right next to the feeder, and they came to the feeder. And then just in the last couple of weeks, we're starting to get all the birds are coming to the feeder, mostly chickadees, nuthatches, some jays, and lately some of the redpolls, I think, are coming in.
Mm-hmm.
But do they not drink much during the colder months, or do they eat snow, or what?
Well, usually water isn't a huge issue for them with snow and ice around, and there's enough, even on a fairly cold day, there's enough dripping and melting on a sunny rooftop or whatnot so that they can find water. And often rather than especially non-moving water that they may not even perceive as a pool, a bit of a drip or something that disturbs the surface is often more attractive than just the, you know, essentially the sheet of open water because of the heating. Whether or not the birds can judge the potential risk to them of being wet, for example, in 20 below zero weather, I'm not willing to necessarily go to that length, but a wet bird at 20 below zero is going to be in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, therefore...
not even 20 below
or
zero.
Or not even that cold. But... as a result, whether or not if they're not using it and getting by, you know, I'd be tempted to perhaps not even keep it out there until such time as things moderate a little bit and you feel comfortable that they can utilize the water and will utilize the water. And in the meantime, while it is available, I think you have to have some faith that the birds know what's good for them and what isn't.
Yeah, I've actually had one of those myself, and I quit using it after talking to a birding expert who said, you know, in that really cold weather, you can actually kill them. They get in that water.
Well, if they lose the insulating property of their feathers, which is what it would do, they're not going to live long.
No, they're not. Thanks, Jeff, for calling. Bob in Oshkosh, it's your turn next. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
I have a question on attracting martens. I guess I'm referring to, I have a house in Hazelhurst, and it's on a lake, and we have a martin house. It's, you know, adequate height. I think it's probably about 16 feet, 18 feet up off the ground. And I clean it out every year, and every year the martins come, and they fly in and out, and they're there for a day, and I never see them again.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, what can I do differently, or is there something that might be discouraging them from using it? This year I was thinking of perhaps mounting a house out off the dock, or with the gourd type homes be more attractive.
I don't know if the gourd type homes would be more attractive. Is it a commercial martin house that you bought, or is it something that you made or had made for you?
It's something that someone had made, so it's got some years on it.
As long as you're relatively comfortable, and in the publications we were talking about a few minutes ago, all of the specs are in there as far as chamber size, hole size, and whatnot. As long as you're comfortable that it seems to be made to those specifications, then what you might want to do is just juggle a location a little bit. Sometimes a little tweaking is all it takes, but also realize that in the Lakeland area, in Woodruff, Minocqua, Hazelhurst area, a lot of lakes, a lot of lakeshore residents, a lot of status associated with having an active martin colony in your front yard. And there are only just so many martins to go around, and they're very faithful to the colonies that they've used or that they belong to over the years. So you're essentially you're in essence in competition with a lot of other people for any available martens that are out moving around, and martin populations haven't been burgeoning in recent years either. So you've got to have the house as attractively placed and maintained as it can possibly be, and even then realize that there's a lot of competition for the martens that are up there.
Yeah.
Is it possible you could give me the sites that I could look those publications up?
The local extension office there, I guess, in closest one to you would be in Rhinelander, mm-hmm. and you may be able to find out on the UW Extension website, but the publication that has quite a bit of martin information in it is called Shelves, Houses, and Feeders for Birds and Mammals, and I think the stock number is NCR338.
You can go to the University of Wisconsin Extension Learning Store, and online, I believe that's online, is it?
It should be, yes.
Should be online.
Okay.
But if you, by the same token, if you're online and you Google Purple Martin House or whatever, I think you're going to get
up too.
You'll get a scad of references, and they're all pretty standard when it comes to the actual specifications.
Okay, it sounds great. Thanks.
And the other thing is, make sure that you're not dealing with any competition from house sparrows, starlings, or anything else that might be using the box.
Yeah.
If even though you may clean it out, if you clean it out too early, and a couple of house sparrows or whatnot get established, that's going to queer the deal as far as the martins are concerned.
All right, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. We have some open lines again, finally, so you can get on with your question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Anne in Ettrick is next, so let's go to Anne. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Our family enjoys feeding birds out here in the country. We have a platform feeder, and for the last couple of weeks, there's this bird that's been showing up, and we haven't been able to identify it here at home. It's kind of robin-like. It's got a beautiful kind of orange tan chest. It's got a black kind of necklace-y martingale kind of thing around its neck. It's right here, right now. It's really beautiful. Yesterday we went to the library and we identified the bird as a varied thrush.
Yes, that's what I was going to suggest. I think over the past couple of winters there have been a few records of varied thrushes in the Wisconsin area. I think it's a western bird. But that sounds like the possibility, and if that's what you keyed it out to, I think that's a good possibility.
So what's this guy doing here?
That's one of the things that attracts people to birds, is that their presence is always open to some question, whether they'll be there, whether they won't be there, and the opportunity to see a really unusual bird always keeps people looking. So, there's no telling whether it was lost, blown off course, just happened to wander in this direction, aided by humans, who knows.
So he's stopping by for a short period?
Maybe. Sometimes they stay, and as we're getting into spring, it may hang around. Obviously, it's not going to do very well during the nesting season if it's a single individual, but at least that one has some precedent, and the source population isn't that far away. If you consider that hummingbird that was down in the Beloit area here in southern Wisconsin last fall, that was a Central American bird that somehow found its way to Beloit. So that's one of the things people enjoy about bird watching, is you always have your eye open for that new record or very unusual sighting.
Well, thanks. It's exciting to see the bird.
It sure is. Thanks, Ann, for calling. And let's go to Chris, I believe, in Mount Zion. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
A couple observations. We feed the birds here as well. We're out in the middle of the woods, about a mile off of any road, a dirt road, near Gay's Mills area. And I saw an American kestrel literally snatch a chickadee off of a dead elm tree right in front of me. It darn near flew right into my face. And it's amazing when you watch the kestrel. It looks like a small hawk, and the way it can navigate through the woods, it's just so fast, almost startling. And we've seen the barred owl just sit right on the bird feeders too, and they're quite large.
Mm-hmm.
But I have some questions. We see a squirrel that mixes with the gray squirrels. They seem to enjoy the bird seed as well. And there's a squirrel out here. Is it a variation of a gray squirrel? It's reddish, and they're always larger. I've seen them from time to time,
And the reddish is usually on the belly or the extremities.
Yeah, like the tail and the ears. Yeah.
That's a completely different species. The two large tree squirrels in the southern part of the state are gray squirrels, which are quite common, especially around people in urban areas. And then fox squirrels, which is what you're seeing, a little bit larger, but otherwise same body proportions, same basic behavior, but more of an animal of scattered woodlots, fence rows, and kind of mixed agriculture and woods. So fox squirrels and gray squirrels coexist very nicely, get along with each other, and would share the same woodlot.
You know, I'm so glad to hear that. I told my partner, Lynn, I said, I think that's a fox squirrel. And she says, there's no such thing. I can't find it in any of our books. And I do have another question. We've had some raccoons around in autumn and through the winter, and they're really strange, ranging in size. But one of the things I noticed is I was walking up from the sauna, and I saw one walking towards me in broad daylight, and it was quite large. And it didn't seem afraid. It didn't seem angry or anything. It just it walked, and it turned around, fell over, and convulsed. And it got up, went a little further away, and did the same thing. And I've seen a couple like that, and I noticed the coyotes had a couple dead ones out in the woods, too. Well, they did eat them. But I don't know what's going on with them. I dispatched the ones that were around the house, just thinking it was the humane thing to do. Do you know what that might be?
Well, first of all, anytime you see an animal like a raccoon that should be nocturnal, out in broad daylight and wandering around fearless or worse yet stumbling or disoriented, that's a pretty good sign that the animal is sick. And the most common affliction that creates that kind of behavior is canine distemper. And there are other possibilities as well, but that's
the main
fairly
one.
Common one. And, you know, if you've seen several cases of it, it's probably worth at least getting a report into the system in your local DNR office. And they'll pass that back to the wildlife health specialists at the Madison level, and they tend to like to keep track of this kind of thing because those kinds of things can be accentuated by the kind of winter we've had where the animals are stressed anyway and then perhaps slightly more vulnerable to disease problems.
Well, that makes sense then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Chris, for calling. Appreciate it. Karen in Madison is up next. Karen, hi to you.
Hi. That was a great segue since we're talking about canines.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening earlier when you were talking about feeding the robins dried fruit,
mm-hmm.
and I just wanted to mention that raisins are highly toxic for dogs. And so if you're feeding on a feeder like I do in the backyard, where my dogs run around underneath now eating the sunflower seeds, they would love to eat the raisins,
mm-hmm.
and that would not be very good for them. It could kill them.
Yeah, raisins. I mean, there are a number of things you're not supposed to give to your dog.
Chocolate,
raisins, grapes, chocolate, and
onions.
So forth. So it's that's a very good point, Karen. Thanks for bringing it up. But if you keep keep your birds and your dogs separate, I guess, is what it amounts to.
Right. That's what I'm finding.
Okay.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Karen, for bringing that up. It's a good reminder. Jerry in Superior is next. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
Good. Hey, I have a little different question. I have plenty of places at the cabin for birds to nest, and they do nest. One of the places I don't want them to nest is under the awning of my boat lift. Because they poop all over the boat.
Mm-hmm.
How can I get them to not nest in the corners of the boat lift?
Well, it's probably going to take some sort of a mechanical treatment because there really is. Birds don't respond very well with a lousy sense of smell to repellents and whatnot. Depending on the configuration of your awning or what the corner joint is like, you could, I'm just going to think out loud of a few things here. You decide what you might be able to modify. With some double-sided tape or the miracle product, duct tape, you could either cover the corners with some construction plastic, heavy plastic, clear. Well, it doesn't matter if it's clear or not, but clear wouldn't be, you know, ugly looking in your boat lift.
Yeah.
So plastic would work because they couldn't get any nesting material to adhere to it nor perch there. You might be able to wrap a small piece of plastic bird netting around the corner. Any garden center carries that black plastic mesh for bird protection. I mean, it may be possible if your awning is high enough from your boat that you're not going to snag it with the windshield as you pull in, or a radio antenna or some fishing rods that are sticking up in the air, then you could stretch and attach a full sheet of bird netting under the entire awning and attach it on the edges, and that would completely eliminate the problem.
Bird netting. That'd be a good idea.
And then lastly, there's a product that kind of collectively or in general goes by the name porcupine wire. It's essentially a bird control product that has these very sharp steel spikes on essentially like a strip of sheet metal. And that, too, could be bent around a pipe or attached. And it's just so spiky, the birds won't go anywhere near it. The problem, of course, you know, somebody jumping out of the boat or grabbing the awning, they're going to end up harpooned by the stuff. So I think you're better off to go with the bird netting, plastic, or any other covering that seems to work that you can shape so that they can't get into those corners.
Yeah, right. I had the same problem for many years, Jerry, so I can relate. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. John in Wausau, I believe, is next. Let's go to John. Hi, John.
Hey, guys. Thanks for the program. I'll preface it with saying that I have nothing against wolves, but we inherited 80 acres northeast of Park Falls in Iron County, kind of sandwiched between federal and state land, and it feels very remote when we're out there, and there's an old hunting camp. And I guess my question is, if I want to take my kids out, we've never stayed overnight, I want to take my kids out, or wife, to see the stars and whatnot, I guess I just get a little spooked by the idea of the wolves. And related to that, I heard recently that the first documented human kill by wolves was just documented somewhere. It was a researcher in, Canada.
In northern Canada, I think. And there's still some debate. I mean, there are experts on both sides of the fence on really what happened there. But if you stop to think about it, John, I mean, one of the reasons why the North Woods is attractive is the sense that it is the North Woods, that it's open, that it's wild, that there are things up there that eat things like me. But that's not exactly what I mean. With the first, as you just said, the first documented case maybe of a human killed and consumed by wolves, and yet that just sends everybody into a tailspin thinking about being outside. Yet, what's our annual mortality on the highway, Larry, in Wisconsin? It must be 1,200 or 1,300 people killed driving to the woods or wherever else in order to enjoy that experience. So the point I'm trying to make is that things that we don't even pay any attention to anymore in our day-to-day lives that are a much higher real risk factor than being consumed by a wolf while you're out stargazing, you know, that is such a remote, infinitesimally small possibility that while we can't say it could never happen, it's sure as heck not very likely, John. So,
that's what my head tells me.
I know, I understand.
But you know, when I'm out there with my kids, I guess maybe the thought that just came to mind was use common sense.
That's exactly right. And not only use common sense, but take some time to read some of the wolf and bear literature and so forth. There are excellent brochures available. There's one from the Wildlife Federation on Sharing the Land with Wolves, I think is the title, which would be very beneficial for you. There's one called Living with Black Bears that the Forest Service puts out. Those kinds of things, I think, will make you feel a lot better and a lot more comfortable dealing with the situation should it ever occur. And it probably won't.
All right. Thanks a lot. Okay.
Yeah, thanks, John. And you're a lucky guy to have 80 acres in a place like that. I tell you what, it's a privilege to have that kind of property. Mike in Franklin, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about my bluebird houses. I raised many broods of bluebirds over the years, but last year, and normally I'm fighting the swallows on the taking over the nest, but this year, last year it seemed to be a little wren. And they're cute little birds and they're fun to watch, but they just drive the bluebirds out of there. Any suggestions?
So are you running a bluebird trail, Mike, where you have multiple boxes, or is this just a couple boxes around the house?
I have three houses around the house, three houses around my yard.
Well, I guess the first thing, there's a little bit of difference in entry size for the wren house versus the bluebird house. I'd be tempted to get a box or two made to the specifications for a wren house and position those and hopefully distract the wren with its own home from bothering the bluebird houses. And realistically, that's about all you can do. Wrens are interesting in their own right. I realize they and, of course, tree swallows compete with bluebirds, but, you know, having your birdhouses occupied by something is a lot better than the alternative of nobody there at all to watch and enjoy.
Right. So they are a fun little bird to watch.
They are. Yeah. So if you can convince them to use a house that you're actually putting up for them and let them keep the rest of their wrens out of the area and therefore leave some space for your bluebirds, that's probably about the best you can hope for.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Our guest today, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Again, we have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Scott, before we go back to the phones, we have some kind of important dates for some people coming up, and maybe we should go through some of those.
Well, for those who enjoy the outdoors, and especially for those who hunt, there are some important dates coming up. One general reminder for both the many, many hundreds of thousands of fishers and hunters in the state is that licenses, of course, expire in March. Mm-hmm. And the new outdoor licenses for fishing, hunting, patrons' license, things like that, will all be on sale, I think, starting on March 10th. So think about renewing your license. Turkey permits, which have been distributed to the applicants who applied by that December 10th deadline, are out, but there were over 50,000 additional permits, generally for the later hunting periods, are going to go on sale over the counter, so to speak, at 10 o'clock in the morning on March 28th. And those can be purchased at the automated license vendors, at the DNR service centers, online and by phone. If you're interested in checking to see what units have permits available and get the details on purchasing them, and I think you can buy them at the rate of one a day until they're all gone, that sale starts on March 28th. And then finally, and even more quickly, there will be a series starting, I think, on the 11th of deer management unit reviews scattered around the state. So if you're interested in deer, whether you're a hunter or a landowner or a farmer who's concerned about deer populations or really from any other perspective, these reviews are a good opportunity to go to the review, find out from the local managers, you know, what's going on with the herd. Is it up? Is it down? What kind of a season are they looking at next year? How many deer will be taken? So on and so forth. So those begin, and you can find all that information on the DNR website. In the southern part of the state where chronic wasting disease is an issue, the chronic wasting disease rule hearings, which are just now being scheduled, are being piggybacked on those deer management unit hearings. So, for example, here in the Madison area, the one in Fitchburg is coming up on the 18th of the month, and that will both be a review of the local deer management units and of the proposed chronic wasting disease regulations for next year, which will be solidified, I think, at the DNR board meeting at the end of March. So a lot going on in the world of deer. It seems like a long way till next fall's hunting season, but the decisions that will dictate what you can do next fall will be made fairly soon.
Right now. Clarence in Egg Harbor, we'll give you a shot now. Hi, Clarence.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question on goldfinches. Last year, I would count as many as 40 or more goldfinches at my feeders in the wintertime. And late this summer and into fall, they gradually disappeared. Now this winter, I don't have any.
And where did they go? Where did those goldfinches go?
Be patient, Clarence. The goldfinches will return. This has been an unusual winter. Not in the standpoint of what Wisconsin winter is supposed to be like. We just haven't had a winter like it was supposed to be like for a long time. And the comings and goings of birds with regard to feeding stations is really dictated by weather conditions and availability of food elsewhere. I don't think, although it's a common tendency to look towards some type of catastrophe, that's rarely the explanation. I think if you bear with the situation, you'll see your goldfinches again when the weather moderates.
Okay.
I used to get about 10 different varieties of birds. Now it's mostly just nuthatches and a variety of three different woodpeckers that come into the feeders. And I do have sunflower seeds out on the ground, and a number of turkeys will come and go, too.
Well, part of that is also a function not only of the immediate weather within a given winter, but in the long-term changes in the landscape in an area that's become more intensively developed, or as it's become developed, there are more people with more feeders, so there's more competition for the available birds, and just changes in the bird scene itself. I mean, turkeys are still a relatively new addition to most of Wisconsin's landscape, and as the bird community changes and the landscape changes, you can't expect things to stay the same at the feeder.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling, Clarence. Appreciate it. By the way, the great backyard bird count, as long as we were talking about bird sightings and stuff, we had, 1,900 participants, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it was a wonderful participation rate, which is good news for citizen science, the notion that folks are interested in getting out there and collecting information that can be used for purposes beyond just recreation. But those 1,900 people reported 112 species and 97,000 individuals. The individuals, the species numbers were about the same as last year. The number of individuals was down a bit. And again, that was attributed to the fact that it's been a tough winter and things have just moved around the landscape. The most common birds, building off what Clarence just said about the lack of goldfinches, the most common species, juncos, goldfinches were number two, mourning doves, chickadees, cardinals, house sparrows, mallard, house finch, crow, and blue jay. You know, it makes my feeder look pretty normal in terms of what's there. And those are the usual suspects. But there were some pretty interesting things, too. A golden eagle was seen, snowy owls, a brown thrasher, which I'd kind of rate up there with the sighting we had earlier of the varied thrush, and some unusual waterfowl. And so, you know, while it's more or less the same, there's always something different. And again, that's why people are out there looking for birds.
Absolutely. Marge in... Or Marg, I believe, in Chippewa Falls. It's your turn next. Hi, Marg.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I had a strange occurrence this fall, and my husband and I were recently talking about it because I just talked to a neighbor who experienced the same thing. Now, we've owned our house for 35 years, and we've had apple trees here. We have four. And we have bear, foxes, coyotes, possums, raccoons. We have everything living in our woods here. But this is the first year in 35 years that within about 3 days, every apple disappeared from the tree and from the ground. Now, we thought that was unusual. It's never happened before. In fact, usually in the winter, I'll get some really nice pictures of the apple trees after a snowfall with, you know, the bright red still hanging on there. And we thought it was unusual, but then about a week ago, I talked with a neighbor who has a small orchard. And he said the exact same thing happened there. He said he's always had to pick, you know, like pears and apples off the ground. Every single apple was gone, and that's a lot of apples. And I was just wondering, since we've had bears here before and never had that happen, would more than one bear feed, like, in our yard like that and not fight or whatever?
Sure. I mean, if you think about the way bears congregate, for example, along a river when the salmon are running, you know, there's a bear every 6 feet grabbing salmon. Animals tend to congregate, even non-social animals that aren't in herds or packs. They'll tend to concentrate around a dump, for example, or a fish source in a river, or perhaps an apple source. So I'm gathering you're suspecting bears are the culprit here.
Well, I at first, when we knew it was just our yard, I thought maybe it was possums since they were gone from the tree itself. I thought it's got to be something. I mean, we have deer as well and bunnies. I mean, everything. I watched a gray fox one evening, a cold, rainy November evening. I watched one lay under the tree for about a half hour just eating apples. And so I've seen everything eat the apples.
Mm-hmm.
But for, I mean, my husband noticed when he was mowing the lawn, he came in and he said, because we have a mulching lawnmower, and he usually just, you know, goes right over the apples because the bunnies go out there. And but he said, come and look. And, like, there were, it was spooky. There were no apples anywhere. So this
was before snowfall.
This was, yeah, probably in October. I mean, we use our apples as well. We didn't do anything different, and the apple crop this year was no different that I noticed. I mean, everything was normal. It's just that within a matter of days, after having apples lying on the ground as usual and some in the trees, all of a sudden we went out, nothing was there. And so my first thought was, because they were gone from the trees, I was thinking what could climb up, and I was thinking raccoons, possums, you know, and probably the deers and the bunnies and whatever took care of the bottom ones. But then,
you know, they're all gone. So bear.
Well, there are a lot of possible culprits. The fact that it had never occurred before makes it a little unusual, but not unexpected. We routinely get calls from people who will say, well, I've lived in this woodlot for 30 years and the woodpeckers never bothered the house, and now all of a sudden they're tearing it up, or the squirrels never really stripped any bark off our maple trees, but the trees are naked, and so on. So these things do happen. With bears, though, I would have expected some damage to the tree if they were crawling around up in there, unless they simply knocked things loose. But I don't know who the culprit is, but doesn't surprise me that it happened all of a sudden.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at the world of Wisconsin wildlife now with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for listening in. Pat in Mosinee has been waiting to ask a question, so let's go to Pat. Hi, Pat.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We have some property along the backwaters of the Wisconsin River north of Stevens Point, and we see a wide variety of snakes, especially pine snakes.
Yeah.
And I'm absolutely petrified of them. And is there any way of discouraging them, removing them?
It would be easier for you to get over your fear, I'm thinking, but just hold. Scott, what do you say?
Well, I mean, pine snakes, which are one of the local northern terms for fox snake, it's the same animal. It's a pretty good-sized snake, blotchy in appearance, and their head's kind of coppery-colored, no markings. Does that fit the snake you're seeing?
I know it's a big snake.
Okay, well, all right. So let's assume it is pine snakes or fox snakes. I mean, Larry was right in a way. If there's anything you can do to kind of accept the fact that these are harmless in terms of they're not venomous, they're, other than that they might startle you, and especially if you have some fear of them, their presence may make you a little nervous, but there's really no risk associated with their presence. In terms of is there anything you can do to discourage them? Well, not a great deal, except I would certainly be cautious around my home, that the sill plate was tightly sealed where the house sits on the sill plate, that there was no possible access to the basement, no way that a snake like that could get inside the house. That's one issue. The other issue is around the house. Take the same care with outbuildings. Minimize wood piles or piles of building materials or just stuff around the yard. The less stuff, the better, as far as minimizing the interest of snakes in being there. And there's only one repellent on the market that I know of. It's a ground sulfur and naphthalene product called Dr. T's Snake Away. Dr. T's Snake Away. And you can get this stuff in a big canister. You probably find it online. And the claim is that if you sprinkle it around the foundation, for example, in a band around the foundation, that will prevent the snakes from crossing that band and therefore having access to the house. Of course, if the house is snake-proof, you don't have to worry about that in the first place. But that's the only non-habitat-related thing that I know of, short of accepting the fact that, hey, they're around, and not just pine snakes. There are probably other species around, too. And just, you know, try and prepare yourself mentally so if you see one, it's not quite the shock that it appears to be.
And it does seem like they're more active, you know, during the breeding time in springtime, and they'll come up from the water and
Yeah.
And it's actually not property that we live on. It's property we have a camper on, and we've cut some of the grass just around that area.
Mm-hmm.
So they just love to cross through. And if I had some class I could take to desensitize me, I would. But.
Well, we're doing that on campus right now in my vertebrate ecology class. We'll be taking up snakes in a month or so. But you know, I think one thing you could start by doing is doing a little more reading about them. The DNR has an excellent little book called The Snakes of Wisconsin, which helps identify them, talks a little bit about snake management and their natural history. And if you do see one where you're not surprised and there's a chance to, you know it's not going to get you or anything, but you have a chance to watch how it moves and what it does and so forth, try and make that effort to watch the snake for a while and learn a little bit more about them. And I think over time, that desensitization that Larry talked about will happen, hopefully.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks very much for calling. I recall a time in Trinidad. I was staying at a sort of a guest house type situation. A little hotel room is really what you call it. And I was eating, and the maid who had been cleaning came running out of the out of my room. There had been a snake in there that had gotten through the window, and the snake came out the door at about the same time the cleaning lady did. And it was quite, she looked like she was doing the polka there, jumping around while the snake went out. So I went into the back into the to the room, and I thought, well, I'll check and see if there were any more snakes in there. So I got down, and I looking under the bed, and just at that time the hotel cat came up behind me. And I had shorts, you know, Bermuda shorts on, and rubbed up against my leg, which caused me a start. And I went right straight forward and rammed my head right into the metal crossbar of the bed. There were no more snakes, but I had a nice big lump on my head. So they can, you know, you can get startled a little bit, but Pat, I hope you do what Scott said and read up on those snakes a little bit and learn a little bit from them, about them. Sue in Saxville, it's your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a suggestion for the fella with the boat lift and the bird nesting.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. We've had luck with toy snakes. We hang them by our back porch lights for the swallows so they don't nest there.
Oh, okay.
You just take a toy snake and you hang it over the light or whatever you need to hang it by, and the birds are bothered by that, and they won't build the nest there.
Well, good idea.
Good idea.
Toy snakes, owl decoys. There's actually a beach ball-like device called a scare-eye balloon that you can,
yeah,
if you have enough room, anything that bounces around or moves or looks right, like a predator might help.
Yeah.
Right.
Thanks,
then,
Sue.
Sure, thanks. Bye.
Appreciate the call. Appreciate the call very much. Helgi in Arkdale has a question or comment, too. Hi, Helgi.
Good afternoon, Larry and Scott. Really enjoy this program.
Thanks.
I got a suggestion for Jerry with his boat lift. I'm 55 years old, and when we were kids on our bicycles, we used to have these colored streamers on the handlebars.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could hang some colored streamers, you know, on the corners of the boat lift, it might keep their birds away, but it also wouldn't be too bad looking. So,
yeah,
that's true. They actually sell Mylar strips for bird deterrents that do dangle like that, and you can suspend them from fruit trees and grapevines and things like that. So there's another idea.
And just a short story. My father was in the Civilian Conservation Corps back in the late 30s in northern Minnesota, and I was feeling sorry for this lady that was afraid of the snakes. But my father, he was so teenager and laying out canoe trails up there. And this old Swede was with him, and hardly spoke a word to my dad. But the frogs were calling my dad at night. And my dad got so frustrated with them, he said, I'm going to kill those damn things. And this old Swede says, you kill those frogs, I'm going to kill you, because that's your best friend, because they're keeping the mosquitoes away from you.
Well, everything has a place.
So. Everything has a place. You're right. Thanks, Helgi, for calling. Appreciate it. Don in Brill, your turn. Hi, Don.
Yes, hi, thank you for the program.
Sure.
I have a question and a short story. I walk my dog daily with a snowmobile trail kind of runs behind our property. And my dog is a Newf, and he's about 200 pounds. And yesterday I was walking on the trail, and he usually kind of wanders about 50 yards ahead of me. And about 20 yards ahead of him, a small bear came out of the woods.
Oh. Hmm.
And they saw each other and just stood cautiously watching. And I froze in my tracks. I didn't know what to do. The dog's very gentle, but he started going towards the bear just, you know, a step at a time. And the bear kind of turned around, was going to go back in the woods. Then he changed his mind, come back out, and they eventually came together. They sniffed each other. And then the bear finally just turned around and walked in the woods. But I've never known a bear to come out this early.
Well, it is a little early, but it's not unheard of. I mean, it is March.
Yeah, how big was the bear?
The bear was, I would judge, maybe 50 pounds heavier than the dog.
Oh.
So it wasn't, you know, it's not a huge bear.
Hmm.
And there is a den in that general area. I've watched it for the past 4 years, and every year it's a huge culvert that runs under the snowmobile trail. And there's been a bear in there every year.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we videotaped it 1 year here a couple of years ago. But I checked that den afterwards, and that bear is still in there. And that's a much bigger bear, so I was wondering where this one come from. And also, I've never heard of such a thing where, you know, the bear wouldn't run away, or, you know, I was scared because I thought there was going to be a squabble going on.
Well, you would have expected that, but apparently the two animals, for reasons we can't explain, came to a meeting of the minds and decided it was in the best interest of both of them to just part company. Now, a bear that's out early is likely a hungry bear that's been essentially sleeping most of the winter and may have had other things on its mind, but certainly didn't appear like it was interested in fighting. And the dog apparently thought better of that, too, so...
Yeah,
interesting encounter, but it could have turned out a lot worse.
Yeah, but it just had a camera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But is it normal for bears to come out that early?
Well, normal is sort of a relative thing. The normal emergence date is a little later, but all these kinds of events in nature happen across a distribution. So there's some early and some very late. Most of them happen at a certain time. It's like white-tailed deer dropping fawns. We always say it's around the 1st of June, give or take a couple of weeks. But we have reports of fawns in April. We have reports of fawns in September. And that's the same for emergence dates or the dates of animals going down for hibernation or migration dates or whatever. There are averages, but there are always outliers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thanks a lot, Don.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Well, I tell you what, we got Fred in Wisconsin Rapids who's been waiting to talk to you, Scott, so let's go there. Hi, Fred.
Hi, guys. I own 15 acres in Portage County north of Amherst.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in an alfalfa field right now, and I'm getting, assistance through the USDA up to $3,500 to put a wildlife scrape in, and I wonder what your thoughts are on wildlife scrapes and what kind of animals or birds I can expect to be attracted by it.
First, what is a wildlife scrape?
Wildlife scrape is usually when they come in with a dozer, and they doze an area, and on the shallow end, it's maybe 2 feet deep, and on the deep end, it's 4 feet deep. This one's going to occupy 0.7 acres, and it'll be about 200 feet long and maybe 75 or 100 feet wide. And then I have to ring it with a buffer area of prairie grass and wildflower seeds. And so... A lot of times scrapes are put in wetland areas. This isn't a wetland area, so I don't know if I'll have to bring in pond clay to line the bottom with or to have a liner put in the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just weighing the pluses and minuses of having it done.
Well, so. I certainly don't see any downside. You may have a bit more work than you anticipate or a bit more cost, and maybe the cost sharing will help with that if you have to seal it with bentonite or clay or whatever, or if you have to put in a liner. But is it possible here they may do the scrape for you and then see what happens with 1 or 2 years of spring runoff or you know, whatever you get for water, see what the water regime is and then decide on the notion of having to line it later, or do you have to make that decision up front?
I'm not too sure. See, the funding is available now, and it's through this, I guess, Farm Act.
Right.
And the funding ends, and then it's renewed, so they don't know if the money will be there.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually have to make my application by March 15th. I'll have till October of 2009
mm-hmm.
to actually, you know, have it done. And, of course, with it being winter, they've got to go out there in the spring and, I guess, do some soil borings and stuff like that. And there's a nice slope to the land,
mm-hmm.
but it, you know, I don't think it's in the water. The groundwater table isn't high, so the only way I think it'll hold water would be in the early spring on the runoff,
mm-hmm.
and then maybe dry up in the summer, unless I go to this route of having the bentonite brought in,
well,
or the liner. And then I've read all these things on the internet where people go to the expense of bringing bentonite in, and then it still leaks. So I'm just kind of weighing that.
Yeah.
I think, first of all, your basic question, is it worth doing? And I'd have to say absolutely yes. The relative value of it to you, you know, 15 acres as an alfalfa field is relatively inconsequential as wildlife habitat. But by putting the scrape in and with the buffer of vegetation, you open the possibility of all sorts of creatures using that. That simply aren't there now. They are obviously on the surrounding landscape, but that could end up as a breeding pond for salamanders or different types of other amphibians, frogs, for example. It would certainly be a source of water for a variety of wildlife. You might get some waterfowl nesting in that buffer grass around the scrape. It depends a little bit on what the water availability situation is within quarter mile, half mile, or a mile of your 15 acres.
We actually, I can't see it, but I think we've right across the road from us within, I'm a guesstimate, maybe a half a mile.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lake within maybe a half a mile.
Well, that's good for you because that provides a source population for some of these animals I just mentioned. So overall, I can see no downside to it. It would be a good thing for you aesthetically and for the local wildlife. Number two, the folks helping you with the cost sharing and with the construction, because they've undoubtedly got a track record of doing many others, should be able to, through those soil borings or their inspections, tell you what the likelihood of holding water is over what period of time. There would be some value in just a spring ephemeral scrape that would have water in the spring and then dry up. But if you're interested in frogs, for example, or salamanders, you'd have to have a little more permanence or persistence in the water so that it didn't dry up before those animals had a chance to metamorphose into adults and be able to leave the pond. So you may have to play some of that by ear, but if they recommend that it should be sealed or lined up front, then I think that's the way to go.
Way to go. Good luck.
Can I ask you just one more quick question?
Sure.
Do you think in the beginning I should ask to see if they can go a little deeper on the scrape? That in the future, if I have to go that liner or bentonite route, you know, I'd still have enough of a deep.
So you've got the leeway to do it without having to excavate again.
That's what I. Yeah.
I think you'd have to ask them that question,
yeah.
But it certainly seems like a logical thing to ask.
Yeah.
And a little extra depth increases the possibility that it wouldn't freeze to the bottom in the winter,
yeah.
Which increases the likelihood that it could be used as an overwintering site for some of these frogs or other species.
Sure. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Fred. Joe in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Say, I've got a question. I've got a garage, and we've got a horse, and we've got a stall attached to the garage, and there's an opening, you know, so the horse can look in the garage, and that's where we throw it hay from. We keep the hay and everything. The in the upper part, the roof pitch is real steep. It's like 12-12. The upper part of the garage, just this year, I've got a gazillion birds up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they're coming in through the opening of the, you know, from the horse,
mm-hmm.
from the stall. But, you know, I bought an owl, you know, a fake owl, and stuck it up there. Didn't seem to make any difference to them.
You got any suggestions? Should I try the snakes over the rafter thing?
No, I don't think the scare tactics. If it's a good spot for the birds to roost, I think you need to look at two things. Number one, first thing I'd do is explore the possibility of some loading dock strips to put over the opening. You know what I mean? These plastic panels that drape down, kind of like shades on a patio door.
Yep.
Those hang down from the top. The horse can push its head through there, no problem. You can throw the hay through there, but the birds can't fly through. And that might end the problem immediately. If it doesn't, or if for some reason you don't want to do that, I guess I'd have a look at the upper parts of the garage and see how much of that you could screen off with a sheet of this plastic bird netting we were talking about a little earlier in the context of the boat launch, the boat hoist situation. Because I've seen at one of our university field stations up in Minocqua, we had to screen the entire boathouse, a three-stall boathouse with bird netting to keep the swallows out of there. But if it's put up properly and tight, you can hardly see the stuff.
Sure.
And it'll last a long time, and it'll completely eliminate the birds. But I've got a feeling if you put those loading dock strips over the opening, you won't have any birds anyway.
Yeah, good suggestion, Scott. Thanks, Joe, for calling. Don and Spooner, your turn. Hi, Don.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Got a quick question here. In the fall of 2006, on a piece of property that I guide on for an outfitter, I had noticed there's huge flocks of sandhill cranes that fly into the middle of this property, and I'd spotted a whooping crane with the flock of sandhills. Now, I'd seen it on and on through the fall, and then through the grapevine, I had heard that it never made it south with the sandhills, and I'm talking with biologists, they had to put it down. Now, this fall, having clients in there, I've seen another whooping crane with this flock of sandhills. I guess my question is, how many of these birds are transplanted in with the sandhills per year?
The attraction to the whooping crane restoration program has been this migration led south by ultralight aircraft that attracts a lot of media attention. And I think the average flock size that they've been sending from central Wisconsin down to the wintering area in Florida has been in the neighborhood of from 10 or 12 to 16 or 17 over any given year, but no more than that.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Donna in Madison, hi.
Yes, hi. This doesn't concern Wisconsin, but my son has a three-story row house in Boston. And he was on the third floor, which has a deck off of it, and he was just sitting in a chair, not on the deck, in the house. And he had the door open, and here comes a raccoon walking into his room. And Dick said to him, "Well, hello, who are you?" And the thing stood there and looked at him a little while and turned around, went back out again.
Yeah. Well, we've had, I mean, closer to home, I've had students report, on apartments on the second or third story along State Street or whatnot, of both possums and raccoons that would actually learn to either come in through a pet door or an open door or sometimes even push through a screen door and help themselves to pet food. And yeah. I had one person who reported a few years ago, a possum that would come every night, walk in, climb up and sit on the couch with them for a little while and get something to eat and then leave. So it happens.
Well, thank you very much for calling, Donna. That's a great way to end the program, I think. Scott, thank you so much. You'll be back the first Wednesday of next month.
Correct.
Hopefully there will be a lot less snow on the ground.
Hopefully.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. And, of course, he will be back the first Wednesday of April. And let's hope there's no snow or very little snow there anymore. I sure hope so anyway. I'm tired of the snow. Just to take a look at what's coming up tomorrow on the program, Gary Knowles will be joining us. And he's a travel writer, of course, and a frequent guest of the program. And he has the candidates for the various categories of best towns in Wisconsin. I've already been to that website and cast some votes. Maybe you want to do that too. You'll be on tomorrow, as will Heather Porter Engwell of the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board to talk about some great Wisconsin cheeses. And that's going to be fun too. I hope she brings some with her. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.